Hello, welcome to episode 11 of the RTE Rugby Podcast. We're available on rte.ie, iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts usually. You can contact us on Twitter at RTE Rugby or Facebook /RTE Sport. And we have a well-populated studio this week. With me here, James Downey. And we'll list his clubs in a little while, but we also have the Ireland Sevens captain, Billy Dardis, who's a celebrity only in the last few days, and he's looking to get back to obscurity, but we're not going to let him. And we also have Wesley Dee and Michael Glennon, with whom I'll start. Michael, what's getting people going on the website?
Good afternoon, Dara. News yesterday about Will Addison. So Ulster released a statement to say that he had just undergone back surgery. Initially popped up before Six Nations or training with ahead of the Six Nations with Ireland, and he has had surgery. They are just hopeful that he'll be ready for pre-season. And I actually rang Ulster to see if they had a pre-season date, and they don't yet, because the Pro 14 has been pushed back a month with the World Cup. So it was the beginning of July last year, and maybe pushed on this year. But that just means that Will Addison is in a race against time to get fit for the World Cup, for those friendlies, which are the 10th of August is the first one.
Was that Italy first? I keep trying to remind
Italy
myself.
Italy at home first, yeah. So it's just interesting with the back, obviously, you don't know, and they can only just be hopeful that he's fit for that stage. Just before we came to studio, Israel Folau was on Instagram again with another crazy post. He said, "Hell awaits for drunks, homosexuals, adulterers, liars, fornicators, thieves, atheists and idolaters." And he'll be in trouble with the Australian rugby bosses there. And there's not much more can be said on that.
No, I mean, it's interesting really outside, if you take out what the content is. And I know people will say you can't do that, but it's not kind of how reprehensible the opinions are. It's whether or not players have a right to express without employer sanction. And maybe they do, maybe they don't. I don't have an answer to that one.
Yeah, I wonder, does that even cross the boundary
in terms of hate speech or whatever?
I don't even know what an idolater is.
An idolater?
I'd look up to you, Wes. I could be in trouble
as well.
The man next to you has just joined Instagram, so he's going to tell us all about Instagram, aren't you, Billy? You're not on Twitter.
No, not on Twitter at all.
Thank you for coming in, and congratulations. We're delighted for you. It's brilliant.
Thanks very much, and thanks for having me. No, I'm delighted to be here.
Pleasure. So yeah, we're going to talk a lot about sevens. Michael, is there anything else we want to get? What about Johnny Holland? This is interesting for you as well, isn't it, James? Because he's one of your players.
Yeah, briefly, Johnny Holland was talking about the passion he felt playing for his native province, and how, well, his career was cut short. He didn't get to the stage at 30 where he might be look on to play somewhere else, extend his career, but he never felt like he would want to play for somebody else. But what we're seeing increasingly now, and Ulster's the main example at the moment, where the people who would be considered the cream of Leinster moving away to other provinces, and Ulster being the main destination at the moment.
Yeah, it's more active. James, how are you? Good to see you.
Very good, Art. Thanks.
It's a pleasure. It's more active now, this kind of unofficial transfer market. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, 100%. I think you look at Munster squad, for example. You've got Joey Carberry, Andrew Conway. A lot of players actually move an awful lot. Connacht squad's full of players from different provinces as well. It becomes, I suppose, if there's a lockjam at some province and a province needs a certain position, that ability to actually swap over and change clubs, it has to be there. I think from an IRFU brief, New Sephora's whole remit, I guess, is to make Ireland as strong as they can. And I guess with Jack's case, ultimately, he's made the decision to go up there. And he's had an injury with his hip, hasn't played behind Keane. Ed Burns played extremely well as well. And he looks at his World Cup chances and says, look, I want to play, and I feel I need to play. Dave Kilcoyne's playing great stuff at Munster too, so it's...
There's a few equations for him, isn't there? Because there's the Leinster dream, which he's had in many ways, and he had the Lions dream while he was with Leinster, but now he's to say, well, my Ireland kind of dream, so to speak, is the one that I have to fight for, and I can't do that here.
Yeah, it is, and it's a tough call. It's a brave call, because I think a lot of players, the easy option is to stay where you are and kind of, you know, been there, done that, and still
dial it in.
Exactly, you know, and he's not that type of player, and he still feels like he's a lot more to give. So this creates a great chance for him up north.
You do represent him, and I'm going to talk to you just about that interesting part of the business. We all have to earn a living, and I mean, you can't earn it from just one thing anymore, even in rugby. I guess you try and do a bit of media and you try and do a bit of agency, etc.
Yeah.
But I know, Wes, you've, you know, in terms of identity, you're very strong, and you make no bones about that, nor should you. So what do you think about the internal transfer market and people who grow up being true Blues suddenly becoming Munster legends?
I think with someone like Jack McGrath, in fairness to him, I'm not just saying this because James is here, but like, I mean, as far as I understand, the mechanics of it is one province can't outbid another for the same player. So it's not financially motivated. He's a guy with, 56 Irish caps and 3 Lions caps. So he could sit there and dial it in. And in a way, you could actually, as Johnny Holland made, you could make the argument that there's arguably a quicker route back to the Irish team by usurping Cian Healy's place again.
That was Johnny's point.
Rather than going, playing well for Ulster and still being left behind Cian Healy for Irish selection, potentially. But I suppose, and obviously it's maximising resources, and James hit the nail on the head when, you know, David Nussfor has been very vocal about, you know, obviously the Irish team's priorities, the financial engine, all the rest of it that we hear. But I do think there is a danger that it's a balancing act to be got, that I think you're in danger of diluting that provincial identity at some level, and that's also an intangible that plays a part in the health of Irish rugby and the Irish team. And in fairness, as good as the product is to watch aesthetically, that's very much been the case of what's happened if you look down at New Zealand. I mean, the true identity and local rivalry is probably more manifest in the ITM Cup than in Super Rugby at this point. So,
I
probably wouldn't want a Munster team with 8 guys from Leinster playing for it, I'll be perfectly honest. And vice versa, I'm sure. But
yeah, exactly. But the whole thing about a provincial identity is one that's like almost, it's an abstract discussion, isn't it?
It's a funny one as well, because Jack is probably the highest profile guy, or the guy to go at the height of his profile. There have been other guys that have gone on to have big profiles, and not just in the direction from Leinster to another team. Mm. Look at Leinster's team that won 3 European Cups with Owen Redden, Mike Ross, Sean Cronin, all Munster players.
All perceived to have done their apprenticeship elsewhere, though.
Mm. Yeah. Exactly. So I suppose Jack is the first time an active international. I mean, Joey Carver's a different.
Geordie as well.
Yeah, I think Jack, even though is maybe a higher level than Geordie Murphy, to be fair, like, he's a higher profile. He's a frontline international for 6-7 years now.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting one, but I mean, it's nothing against him. It's just something I think you can't.
You just have to
keep a little bit of a balance with. Yeah.
We have the right man in studio anyway, because it's all barrels. So you've played for James.
Yeah.
Was the passion there everywhere you went?
Well, look, I guess from my point of view personally, when I was playing, I had these lads, Darcy and O'Driscoll, ahead of me in line. So, like, personally, what was I going to do? Just kind of stay there? I said, well, I wanted to play. Connacht gave me an opportunity and I went and took it. Didn't mean I tried any harder or I didn't put my whole heart into it when I was at Connacht. And look, I played for Munster as well, and I was nearly more Munster then at that stage when you wear that red, you know. And I don't, like, there were some Leinster lads there and some of them are still there now or born in Leinster. But you buy into it when you're down there, and it's not about, you don't think that, I'm still a Leinster man. You buy into that whole situation the way you are.
It's probably more an issue among supporters than players.
Yeah, and I think so. As well, if you got success as well, like, do they want that? Or do they want, we'd prefer to have a purely Munster, born and bred, and not have as much success? Maybe it puts a bit of pressure on some of the academies and stuff to produce.
Or conversely, it takes pressure off them.
Yeah.
When you can bring in players from another province at a younger age.
Well, it's part of the romance of sport again, and romance is important because, like, at some level, I suppose our love affair with sport, everyone in this studio started as children and watching it, and there is a perception that there's a kind of a two-way umbilical cord between community and team, and a lot of it is nonsense, but all it needs is a few flicks of it, a few to say, oh yeah, there's a guy from my town in Tipperary, which means you can buy into the whole team.
Well, just to tell you a short one, when I was growing up, I was from County Offaly, but I always considered Leinster a cold house for culties.
Mm.
So I would have associated more with Munster, the way they played the game, the 10-man rugby, all that sort of thing. But now I see that Leinster have done training sessions in Edenderry. They've come out to have a community club rugby officer. He's out in the schools. So you see the Leinster flags now when Leinster are playing. So if I was growing up now in Edenderry, I would be a committed Leinster fan. As it was, whatever, I'm 40 now. So when I was growing up, I naturally felt more affinity to Munster.
Leinster rugby is more inclusive now in its appeal to
Absolutely. Even what they're doing down in the provincial towns like Edenderry, it's just, you'd be definitely a Leinster fan. I see them going around with their Leinster.
And then you see Tadhg Furlong and you see Sean O'Brien.
Tadhg Furlong was funny, like he's from Campyle, which is very near the border with Waterford.
Right.
And he was meant to be going to UCC. And he was offered a sub-academy place with Munster, as far as I know, and that was trumped by an academy place. And Jesus, like, I'd say whoever made that offer is really regretting it now.
Never mind how UCC feel about it. Like, but, you know, the realities of the profession dawn on you too as well. How old were you when you went to Munster, James? Roughly, like, just, you weren't fresh out of the box anyway at that stage.
I was 30, was it 30?
Post-Northampton.
Yeah, 30, yeah.
So you know the realities of the game are, yes, that the identity matters, but the identity isn't something abstract to you. That's a professional identity, which is different to the romantic identity that you have in the stands, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think from a player's point of view as well, I know Johnny kind of mentioned it, it's also a business. And people, I understand the supporters' point of view. When you're a player and you're brought into an office and you're being released, it's a business decision. So players, conversely, then need to have that ability to be able to go, well, actually, it is a business. I got to look after myself, my family, whatever it is. And you got to go where the jobs are, you know, ultimately. And if there's a job abroad or if there's a job somewhere else and you're going to do your job,
yeah.
Why would they not? Like, you know, and I just, for me, that was my option to come back and I wanted to come back and, no matter where it was, it didn't really matter.
But what I'm trying to get at is there certain players can, you know, effortlessly fit into an identity that might have been the one that they were motivated to hate 5 years previously.
Oh, no, okay, I can understand
he's
that.
He's trying
one.
To say you were more a Munster player in your style than a Leinster player. He's not being
I'm just trying to access his tribal identity, where it really lies, you know?
I don't know. I can jump between a few camps on that one, so it's not too bad, depending on the day.
Come here, the agency stuff, because the man next to you now, they're going to need some representation, some of these sevens players, which will become household names within rugby supporters anyway. What is the state of play with agents in Ireland? Because I always think it must be a great job in one way, because rugby's booming, blada, blada, and we have such a kind of a human resources glut. But at the same time, the money doesn't really stack up for you. I mean, if you're getting 10% of a guy on 80 grand, you can't run an office on that, can you?
No, well, I'm lucky enough that I work with Sportif, who would be a global agency. So we'd have offices in New Zealand and France. And
so you're on a retainer?
Yeah, exactly. So, like, I don't have the gun over my head to say, bring in 10 players and this is, like, start producing. Yeah, I have to produce, but as anyone else would. But for me, it's I joined a team that have a stable already in place and have a quality stable, and we're at line up now as well. Dave McHugh's place, and
Dave.
Yeah, so we have obviously access to.
He's been at it forever too, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Darcy and Carney.
Yeah, So Dave's obviously do the contracts for the player contracts, and Dave does all the commercial as well as his own players.
But what's the kind of core mission? If you had one thing, the old famous genie came out and he said, right, James Downey agent, you can have one gift here. Would it be to get a guy at 19 who goes on to be a Richie McCaw, or would it be to have a stable of 6 or 8 good earners?
Oh, I think it's, if you could get someone from my point of view now, where I am at, if I could get someone who was just coming out of an academy or something and they went on, it's kind of, you're there from the start to the end. It's great picking up other lads across the way that are different journeys, part of their journey. But for me, the whole finish would be a good one.
What's the story, Wes? I know you're pally with an agent or two, and you do run into, it's not exactly a...
It's just to get information. I don't really like them at all.
Yeah. I mean, who's the man that you're pally with? I met him with you once. He had a cup of coffee. Pleasant fella.
Well, probably Carl Hogan, probably Carl Dave Hogan, McHugh. Yeah. Probably a few of them, really.
And they're all affable fellas. Like, and I just wonder, I mean...
The part I find interesting about it, I don't know what James thinks, it mightn't be so much in Ireland because everyone knows everyone. There's only so many players. But I think, I don't know, does this happen in soccer? Maybe the resources are so much bigger that it doesn't have to. But I find that agents actually have a huge... maybe a disproportionate say in the actual transfer market generally, or transfer market's a strong word, but I think a lot of clubs will recruit, their recruitment will be driven by a list that an agent presents to them rather than I've scoured every league in the world and this is the player I want. I think sometimes the agent, possibly inadvertently, is a huge driver in the movement of players all over the world, you know?
To a certain degree, I can understand that, but initially, when we go to a club will say they'll have their meetings now at the end of this year about who they're retaining next year and say, right, okay. Say, for example, Scott Farley's up at the end of next year, so Leinster might want to get someone in to replace him. So we'll give the players that we have in that position.
So you look at the pipeline, yeah.
Exactly, and we have those open and honest chats with these managers who are saying, look, this is who we have, this is what we're looking for next year, be it whatever position, and these are our players off contract. And then it kind of goes from there. So I don't think it's as much of, oh, we're just trying to throw in players in.
But I suppose if Ulster know they need a second row, hypothetically, and obviously this, it makes sense that this would be the case, but I think they start from a list of who's available.
Yep.
They don't start from, well, who's the best second row in the world and who's the second best and who's the third best. They actually, through multiple conversations with different agents, it will be a list who's available. And again, that makes sense. People are in contract and all that, but I don't know. It's not the way you kind of think, maybe.
As opposed to...
You think teams go out and say, right, we want a blind side. Yeah. I'm getting Rocky Elson.
Yeah. That's soccer. That's how it works in soccer.
Then you're talking the big finances you're going to have to pay to buy them out of that contract.
You imagine Toulon maybe now when they got Nanu, and these guys probably did in a bespoke way go directly after him.
Probably, yeah.
But your point about contract is because buying out a contract is a whole other transaction. Completely, isn't it? You want to know who's available in whatever it is, May, June. Yeah.
Exactly, and you saw how well that's worked for Toulon, So it's not necessarily the right way of going about it. We want the best, so we'll just get them all together. It's just
an interesting kind of thing in the game, I suppose. I didn't really realise till quite recently.
And fluid, like most other things in rugby at the moment, in terms of the intersection of finance and the sport and all the rest of that. Billy Dardis, do you have an agent?
No, not right now, no.
Not right now.
No, you wouldn't really need it.
You're being eyed up hungrily there. Like. tell us, the your own... We talked about academy paths and all the rest of it. You were on the 20s team with... who's Ross Byrne was there, and Gary Ringrose, rough contemporaries of yours in UCD as well?
Yeah, that Irish 20s team, I think all of them are playing professional rugby now. You had Jacob Stockdale and Stephen Fitzgerald and stuff like that. So kind of look at myself as a bit of a failure from that. But they're doing pretty well at the moment.
Tell me about the failure, because in one hand you could say maybe it is a failure. I don't know. I mean, did you want to, when you were playing 20s, play 15s professionally?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Oh, no, I think it's probably a bit harsh calling that a failure. That's more my own doing, probably.
Yeah, in your own head. Target for you.
Yeah,
for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I grew up for years and all I wanted to do was play for Leinster in Ireland. So that was my dream. And I'd never actually watched sevens until probably a year or two before I started playing it. So that's why it's funny when people are like, have you always dreamed of going to the Olympics and playing the World Series? And no, and every player on our squad is probably lying if they're saying that that's all they've ever dreamt about. But for the last two or three years, we've worked so hard, stupidly hard for it. So to get onto the series now is pretty cool. So
it's fabulous. I mean, and everyone rejoices in that. And you know, let's not pick holes in anything. Let's just relax and enjoy the fact that you and a bunch of fellas are spending your 20s doing something at the top level and getting paid 18 grand a year for it.
I don't know how anyone heard that figure, but
don't worry.
Go back to UCC and to the kind of the flirtation with a career in the 15s. When did it kind of, was it somebody who said to you, say, Billy, look, I don't think it's going to happen for you? Or was it you yourself looked at what was around you? Or did you suddenly happen upon 20s or on sevens the year after that kind of 20s experience and go for it? Or when did you veer off?
What was the cycle?
I
did 20s. I did 2 years of 20s, went down to New Zealand and then went to Italy with the 20s. Then I did I did 3 years in the academy, 1 year development. And then at the end of that development year, I had picked up sevens. I started playing sevens. And then when I heard I was getting let go.
That's what I kind of want to talk about, because not just for you, but there's so many, we're producing a surplus of excellent rugby players now. Not all of them can have a home in the game professionally and get paid for it. So that PFO discussion is a tricky one, I guess, is it?
Yeah. And it's hard when you get told that there's no contract for you. I think I was dragged out of a Leinster dressing room and told, yeah, there's no contract here. We're signing James Lowe, so that's our back three taken up. And it's kind of a big shock. You're kind of like, all your kind of dreams are kind of smashed there. But then I came out of it for a few weeks and Anthony Eddy was just like, look, I don't know what your plans are, but if you want to play, like, we'd love to have you. And this program's going to step up a gear in the next 2 years just because we're looking to go to the Olympics and get on the World Series. So he kind of put that to me.
And he's been as good as his word, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. And he's like, but he's given me a good opportunity. He's basically given us a job for the last 2 years.
So that snapped you out of it then?
Yeah, like I said, I was looking around, but I didn't actually have any offers. Like, I had no other offer. I had an agent at the time and he was said, like, Bedford Blues and the Championship, and to be honest, I was kind of like, I don't think I'll get much out of that. I don't want to do it. I've just always wanted to play for Leinster, and I don't want to do it. And you kind of look at people and lads are like, well, then you obviously didn't want it that bad, but I did, and just thought sevens was more for me. Just sounded a bit more attractive, and thankfully it was a good decision.
And before we talk about sevens and the exciting year to come, what were your plans outside rugby, or if any?
Well, I was just in the middle of a degree, so I had another a year left to do in my degree. I did a sports science degree in UCD. So I had that. I've finished that now. But no, there was no other real plans. Nothing was really tying me down or anything like that. So, yeah.
Is the notion that sevens is a potential pathway back to 15s dead at this point? Would you even want to? If Connacht approached you in the morning and said, we have a contract here for you next year, how would that work in your head? Is it an end in itself, or do you still see it as something that might lead to something else?
Yeah, I always, in my head, like, I have my own ambitions and dreams and stuff like that. Nice lads, a lot of the lads in the sevens have given up on those 15s dreams, but in my head, I'm still a kid and I still have those dreams. I always dream about playing for Ireland and playing in the Aviva, so that's still my ambition. And it was funny, when I was talking to a journalist before Hong Kong, he was saying, like, have you given up on 15s? And I was kind of like, no. And then he was like, okay, let me put it to you another way. If you got to 35 and you retired and you'd only played sevens, would you be happy? And I just said, no, absolutely not. So I don't know what way it's going to go from here personally. Like, it's kind of a rocky path. You don't know what way it's going to take you. But I think for the moment, for the next few years, well, the next year or two anyway, I've worked so hard to get onto the series that I have to, and I'm going to love it. So, but we'll see after that. We'll see what comes up.
In that way, the platform is great, that you will have the exposure you're going to have to actually to show. Because even from what we were watching on the sevens, you could see the skills that are across both codes that were very evident from a lot of the players. So that's where you are now is a great chance to show off that as well.
Yeah, I think over the last few years, like, people have asked, is it a good pathway to get into, like, provincial squads? And maybe because we were playing in lower tiers, it wasn't. So, like, it's not like we were playing international high level sevens rugby. Whereas now we're going to be playing, like, the best in the world, and then it's got, like, you have more of an opportunity, or be more kind of transferable maybe into Pro 14.
And I test yourself more regularly as well, isn't it? I mean, because ultimately you've got to believe in yourself, and you're not going to do that if you're caning whatever it is, Georgia, every second week.
You know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you'll be coming up against the best and you'll be able to get a run of games and more confidence and everything. So you're playing six games a weekend, and you can have some really bad games and you can have some really good games. So it's not just one game a weekend.
I think as well, just in terms of, like, when you're playing sevens and you can go into 15s, if you look at how some of the other nations do it as well, some of the All Blacks have gone on to play 15s as well. Some of the Aussie boys, English boys as well, go back and play club as well. So I completely agree with you. It's the exposure and that skill level. It's such a high-pressure environment and you're playing in front of crowds. They don't daunt you. It's normally a younger age that lads are playing it as well. So
they have a bit of mileage left in them.
And they have exposure, and then they can still go, actually, if they do want to go on, there can be that progression.
What would you worry you'd lose? I mean, you've played sevens, James. What would you worry you'd lose from immersing yourself in, albeit top-quality, sevens?
Oh, I don't know, to be off the top of the head.
Like, it's obviously collision skills, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, well, a lot of that, rucking's rough enough in that as well, but I just think, you certain guys who are specialists, seven specialists, and you look at some of the Fijian boys who are pure seven specialists, and then some of them have obviously gone 15s, but I just think that some of the skill sets, it is a lot of that rucking stuff, isn't it, and mauls and stuff like that, and just your basic plays off phase play, off striking phase, just different numbers in the field as well, roles.
You don't think you become diseducated to the 15s game, no?
No, not really, no, because it's the main thing is your catch and pass is still crucial, no matter what level you're at. If you can catch and pass under that pressure that they're on in a sevens game, you know, and if a ball's just behind someone, the whole move's gone, or if something else happens, some small thing, you know, that a defence can recover. So I do think that if you can do it there, you can bring it into a 15s, you'll be a lot more comfortable, and you can work on those other skills, like catch and pass, they'll be your pure basics, that if you can get them right.
Are you free, Billy, to play any club rugby, or are you exclusively signed up to the sevens, and is there provincial sevens, or are you playing club sevens, or is there anything like that beneath the national side?
No, at the moment there's nothing, so that's what hopefully, like, on the back of this it will improve, so maybe you'll get more of a structure. I think they're looking at bringing into schools rugby first, try and get that pathway, and maybe clubs rugby as well. But I think on that, like, from talking to, like, Hugo Keenan, for example, he's played for Leinster this year, and he said going back to 15s was a lot easier, than going back into 7s. He said, like, just the transfer, you just are more confident, and then you can come back into 15s, and you feel a lot sharper, a lot faster. I think it's because you have that kind of volume under your belt, the amount of running and stuff like that.
You're absolutely cherry ripe in terms of physical conditioning.
Exactly, and you have a lot more time to rest than 15, so when the time does come, you're almost 100%. Mm.
And are you playing anything with Ternure, or can you go and play with them?
Sorry, no. On our contract, it says we're not allowed to actually play like any other code unless Anthony allows
us. Sure. Yeah.
So, like, a lot of lads... Mark Roach, for example, when he was coming back from his injury, he played a few games for Blackrock. So it's kind of, we're not allowed to play week in, week out, but if he wants us to play, we will.
Yeah, and let's just relax and enjoy the fact that, like, Ross Byrne and Gary Ringrose won't have Olympic rings. You possibly will. But, you know, that remains to be seen. It's a tricky qualification process. But you were in the Hong Kong, the Dubai, the Vancouver, wherever else. Like, London, as we were saying, is the most boring stamp on your passport. It's a wonderful life experience.
Yeah. We were talking about it afterwards. Like, it really hasn't sunk in what we've gotten ourselves into. But, like, we were talking on Sunday night, like, what's going to be your favourite leg? Like, what are you going to look forward to? Brilliant. And lads were like, oh, going down to Sydney. And like,
Vegas looking was at, popular, I'd say, was it?
Yeah, Vegas actually taking off the series next year. So we're trying to figure out what the American leg's going to be. But
is it San Francisco? Is that for the World Championship?
We were in San Francisco for the World Cup in July. That was class, playing in AT&T Park. But yeah, no, like Sydney, New Zealand, Dubai, Cape Town, Singapore, Vancouver. It'll be unreal, so...
And were the women,
London,
the women are on the World Series.
Paris and London.
Did I hear someone that they've been in touch with some of the player, the squad, your squad, to tell you what it's like being on the merry-go-round?
Yeah, a little bit. Like the Women's World Series up till this year, this is the last year of it, they've only had, I think, 6 legs a year, whereas the men are on 10. But the girls are now getting up to 8. That's, and right, I think, yeah, 6 of those are going to be in the same place. But like, we've actually been to a lot of World Series events, like in Dubai. We played as the invitational team, but it's the same event. It's just one big rugby sevens festival. And then we were in London and Paris. So we have a fair idea of it already. And to know that we're going to be doing it all the time next year and be one of the teams competing all the time is pretty cool.
What will it take time-wise? I mean, is this going to be a commitment of... 40 weeks of the year type of thing for you? How are you going to work that out? I know you do. Look, I suppose another way of putting it, do you have to do a lot of your own fitness training from your own willpower?
I think, yeah, this year we had to do a good bit, just like around Christmas, like, because lads are from all parts of the country. You can't be together all the time. So we had 2 weeks off Christmas, and we had to do a few grim running sessions by ourselves and a few gym sessions by ourselves. But
where's base? Where is kind of when you gather together as a squad? Is it in the city that you're playing, or have you a base in Ireland?
Yeah, at the moment we're in Lansdowne Road. So there's a house, 62 Lansdowne Road. That's the sevens and women's base. So that's a house, and that's just all the offices and meeting rooms. Then we train on Lansdowne pitch.
Where did the Colchis stay then?
for the last few years, they've been put up in the hotel, Sandy Mount Hotel. But then we kind of...
Jeez, I remember when that place was teetotal.
but now they've all moved up to Dublin. So we're all kind of living around the base now.
Very good.
But we're moving out to Blanchardstown now, out to the sports campus. The RFU have built a centre out there.
Yeah. Because you're co-funded as well, aren't you? I mean, I don't fully understand, but there's the Olympic element and the Sport Ireland fund, and there's the RFU funding, and there's all the rest.
Yeah, I don't really get it either.
You don't have to worry about it.
I think now that we're on the World Series, I think we qualify for the Olympic funding. But
pay rise?
No comment.
Get to Ems on the case.
Yeah, you'd want a few extra bob for that. I mean, is the Sevens a profitable kind of entity in itself? Because again, like I know it as the road show that you turn on the telly and you just watch like a fantastic few hours of rugby from these amazing spots. Who owns Sevens? Is it IRB or World Rugby, I presume?
Yeah, I think it is World Rugby through this World Seven Series thing, but... I don't know if it's profitable, to be honest with you.
Which is the question that kind of leads to, which is slightly kind of, I suppose, letting the air out of the balloon. But where does the money come from to fund a proper Sevens programme? And does it, is it taken away from other? So,
well, I suppose good causes. Like, that was kind of maybe when it was being started. I know there's all this talk that, you know, Devin Nussafour, when he came in, one prerequisite of taking the job was that a proper Sevens programme be established. And it was kind of this rugby hipster thing of, oh, Ireland are so far behind not having a Sevens programme. Look at all these All Blacks that played Sevens. But, like, that's not to take away from or add to Sevens in any degree on its own. But I suppose a lot of that debate was caged in seeing it as a development tool for 15s. But in reality, like, that's not really going to be the case, you wouldn't think. I mean, I presume if you've maybe 20 guys in training to some degree, I mean, 15 of those are going to have to be committed to this. There'll be a couple of guys from academies or a little bit further down the provincial pecking order that'll jump in and out. But, I mean, so far, I mean, off the top of my head, I think Dan Goggin played a bit, Alex Wooten, Tom Daly, Ballacoon up in Ulster maybe, probably the most notable one that really jumped from nowhere to prominence. So it's probably just a perspective that we have to stop looking at its relevance to 15s and start to enjoy it for
as
itself.
An island of its own.
But that's kind of a bigger global thing with Sevens, and like obviously America are top of the pile at the minute. And people put this into the equation of, you know, this white elephant of the growth of American rugby that everyone's always after. But probably what happens is America's success in Sevens maybe actually works against their 15s development at some point, because especially when you're dealing with a lot of crossover athletes, the adjustment to Sevens is so much easier. Yeah. And like, say, this Nations League happens, you could easily see Fiji, Samoa, like Fiji, obviously, it's their national sport already, but I could see them like really doubling down even further into Sevens, because you're outside the top tier of 15s. All your most promising players leave to play in Europe when they're 16 and end up playing for France, England, whoever. So...
You're right, Sevens for us is like a bonus that's come from nowhere.
I think people talk a lot of stuff around it without like really examining where it might lead, you know, and for good or bad.
What do we need to agonise on, seeming as if you're in the mood for it? Like, I mean, what is the...
I don't think we necessarily need to agonise over anything, but I think viewing it as a development tool is possibly, a little disrespectful for one and maybe not accurate for two.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, I think. Like, you're going to have three quarters, if not more, of them seven specialists. And that's the way it is, like, you know. And I think players can come up then and kind of... Some guys have the skill set for sevens 100%, and that's all they're going to be, and that's fine. And some guys are 15s, and that's all they're going to be, you know. And that's fine too. So I do think that it's a different area. It's a different route for players to go down, you know. If they don't make it in the pro, or if they don't have a certain skill set or whatever... Be it size, be it whatever you need in the pro game in 15s.
It's probably a really good way to introduce kids to rugby in non-traditional rugby areas as well. But maybe they end up becoming sevens players. I don't think they're playing rugby of some sort. It's all good.
It's just the shape of the ball.
They're different games, essentially, at this point.
surplus labour is the other point, isn't it? Because, I mean, England, New Zealand, Australia always had it. Like, we've just had it in the last 4 or 5 years. We have guys like Billy, like, who are smashing athletes coming out without professional contracts. So, I mean, that's the other... The labour market, such as it is, has changed. Why don't we talk about the Pro 14? Because there's a couple of weeks to go in the regular season, and all the Irish provinces, bar Leinster, of course, who have kind of home advantage nailed down a long ago, have plenty of... well, there's plenty of rugby to be played, I suppose, and plenty of games to be won against their nearest opposition in some cases. And we'll kick that off by hearing from Tom Farrell, because what was the background to this piece, Michael?
Obviously, Connacht doing some media ahead of Saturday's match against Cardiff, and we sent Darren Frehel down to chat to Tom Farrell.
Tom Farrell, welcome to the RTE Rugby Podcast. Great to have you on board today.
Thanks. Great to be on board. First time.
Now, the beauty of the podcast is we don't get to see your eye, but yeah, you've looked like you've been in a couple of rounds with Mike Tyson. How are you feeling?
It's actually all right. I probably feared for the worst when it initially happened. I got a boot to the eye on the side of the pitch. And
this was last weekend against the Italians?
Yeah, exactly, last weekend. Tried to play on then for the second half for a minute or two, but I was probably a bit of a liability to the team if I decided to carry on.
So it's a badly bruised eye, only a face a mother could love, Tom.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's I got a few tests from the doctor and stuff, and it's all good. So ready to go this week.
So, and are you looking forward to this week? Because it's a huge game, isn't it? How big is it for you guys?
Yeah, absolutely huge. I think everyone listening and everyone out there watching knows the magnitude of the game for us. It's, if we win, we're qualified for the Champions Cup and we're into the knockout stages of the league. So we know the magnitude of the game this week.
And I guess that's why you came to this province, to be involved in competitions like that.
Yeah, definitely. I think over the last maybe 2 seasons or so, we've been building towards this now. I think the team, the staff, the players and our fans, we deserve to be in the Champions Cup next season. So that's something we're aiming for.
Now, looking back at last weekend, I always look at these matches as matches you just can't win because so much is expected of you. Is it fair to say it was a nervy enough sort of performance and you just about got over the line to get the result?
Yeah, it probably wasn't one to watch back anyways. It wasn't much to watch in the highlights. But they're the type of games, I suppose, you kind of have to grind out and win, because maybe this time last year we might have went over there and kind of turned into a slog and we were on the wrong side of that result. So I know it wasn't the prettiest performance or our best, but like at the end of the day it was 4 points and we'll move on. We've looked at the game and we've moved on pretty quickly.
Is it any indication that maybe there's a bit of nerves in the camp because it's coming to this critical part of the season where you have to win these games and you have to get the points?
I don't think it was nerves. I think it was just, like, to be fair to Zebra, they played quite well. They done their homework on us and they fronted up on the day as well. And they're a pretty proud team at home. Like, so we weren't going over there with the aim of like running riot or throwing the ball around. We respected them. They're steeped in international. So we knew going over there like that was going to be a tough game. Probably obviously could have played better, but we're just happy to get the result, really.
What about Cardiff? What can you tell us about them? What's the challenge that you're going to be facing this weekend?
Obviously, there's a lot of boys there coming back from the Six Nations, so they'll be coming back with a lot of confidence. They're in and around the same position as us in the conference, like, so we know it's kind of neck and neck at the moment. And the last two or three games against them now, we've been on the wrong side, so we're under no illusions this week. It's going to be a massive game for us.
And there's a bit of pressure as well. Is it important that the game is at home?
Yeah, absolutely. It makes such a difference for us when we're coming out here to a packed sports ground. Like, it kind of gives us that extra kick and that extra bit of momentum in the important stages of the game.
And obviously the reward is there. It's dangling. Champions Cup, a place in the knockout stages. It almost feels like a cup final. Do the players feel it's like that as well?
Well, it's essentially his that we're kind of treating it as a cup final, because we don't really want to have to go down to Thomond Park next week needing a result and needing other results to go our way. So if we, as Friendly's alluded to, like, if we can keep winning our own games and keep our destiny in our own hands, that's what we're looking to do.
It's kind of funny, Tom, if you look over the two conferences, the way it's divided up, Connacht have the fourth best record among all the teams. I think that might surprise a lot of people. I bet it doesn't surprise you.
No, I'd say it's probably a fair indication of where we are at the moment. We'd like to think that we're a top four team. I think with that point, though, there's a maybe ranked fifth, sixth, seventh. It's all pretty close around there. So we're probably just about fourth, I'd say, if that's the case. But we're happy to be there at the moment, and I think we deserve it at the moment.
And your reflections on the season in the build-up to this game, how do you think it has gone on a whole for you?
Probably on the whole, it's been definitely positive. There's been a steady progression and we're in a happy place at the moment. Just one last step to go now. Hopefully this weekend we can do it.
And the toughest one maybe, the toughest step?
Yeah, probably will be, yeah.
Obviously, you're involved in the Six Nations squad, training with the extended squad. What was that experience like for you?
It was brilliant. Probably brought me on that bit more. Going up to the camp, I kind of knew the pressures and the intensities of it all. But when you're experiencing it firsthand, it can be a little bit daunting at first. But you kind of you settle in and you kind of become accustomed to it, and it really does bring you on.
And I guess the campaign itself didn't go too brilliantly, but as a group, is the vibe good ahead of what is such a very important year for all the international players?
Yeah, I still think it is. I don't think, if you look back in the last probably 18 to 24 months, like, I think they've only lost a handful of games, or so. Like, I don't think there's need to be crying out yet or calling the May Day call, because we're still in a good position. Probably won 90% of the games, if not more, so I think it's still in a good position.
And has it whet your appetite?
Yeah, definitely. It's just make you hungry for being there. When you're training with these type of players, you just kind of want to get that, push on to that next step and get that first cap.
And I guess to do that, you need to do well with your province, and it brings it all back to this weekend, and maybe more important than most, especially for you.
Yeah, hopefully we can win this weekend now, and it'll put us on into the knockout stages, and that's where we can really showcase the team we are.
Thanks for joining us, and good luck at the weekend against Cardiff.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
Thanks to Darren Frehill for that piece with Tom Farrell. We'll start with Connacht. Yeah, so Connacht have the straight shootout, don't they? Is this Connacht Cardiff?
Yeah, that's on 3 o'clock
in
on
Galway.
Saturday. Yep.
Yeah,
in Galway.
Good one, that one.
Yeah, because obviously, because Cardiff are in the mix as well, and they would leapfrog with a win. So all on that, and that would guarantee, as Tom said, Champions Cup qualification, which is what Connacht have been aiming for. For the last few years,
it's third place guaranteed if they win.
It's third place guaranteed, so it's the top three in each, and then there's a playoff for the fourth if necessary.
Yeah, the fourth versus
for the seventh.
Fourth versus fourth place for the seventh place. We won't go there, and we won't go there to quarterfinals of the Pro 12 either. We'll just keep it to getting into what the immediate objective is for Cardiff, or for Connacht. It's win,
and they're guaranteed. Yeah,
okay.
The same Munster in the same conference, they're guaranteed to be second at least, and they kind of want Leinster to be Glasgow.
Leapfrog Glasgow,
yeah,
don't
and
they?
Like yeah. Glasgow, like Leinster are just running their second team, obviously, and for good reason. And Glasgow know that a win against Leinster second team will clinch top spot for them
in Dublin.
That's in Dublin,
and they've Edinburgh at home last game, which is tricky-ish. Whereas what Munster have,
Munster have Connacht at home.
Connacht at home, Benetton away this weekend.
Yeah, no gimme there.
Well, I don't think the Benetton one.
In between.
You'd imagine Benetton would fancy that, because Johan van Graan has even come out to say that you just get one shot at the European semi-final, so all the eggs will be in that basket. They're not going to risk.
That seems a bit of a change, James, from when you were there and going back even to Declan Kidney's time. But I suppose the thinking always was, we'll get our first choice team on the field the week before the European game, whereas now van Graan seems to very much gone the route of, we'll rest everyone the week before the European game.
It has
game.
Changed.
Yeah. And I would have always thought that 2 weeks before, the lads get rested up. Week before, everyone comes in, gets used to the plays, and then you roll out then, and everyone's used to combinations again because they've been away with Ireland or whatever. But now, yeah, it seems to have been an interesting change, and it's a bit
it's
of pressure
a change of
on
philosophy,
guys.
Isn't it? Because yeah. I remember, like, you could set your clock by the headlines. Big guns rolled out for Munster's last league game before European showdown, and now that's changed. Why? Is it just physical attrition? Is that?
Yeah, it seems to be. I don't know, and I guess it's coaches seem to have this preference. I think it's a bit of, personally, I'd prefer to get a bit of a form under my belt and get some game time, but as opposed to drop in and go right, start producing and. Mm. Guess that's the way it's going.
Mm-hmm. Just to go back to that, so Benetton we mentioned, so they've 52 points, Ulster 54 with games away to Edinburgh, and Leinster at home again in their last match, which would be tricky in other circumstances, but that's a dead rubber for Leinster, and Edinburgh still in there on 51 with Ulster at home. So I suppose that's the game, isn't it? Ulster-Edinburgh, that's their playoff. So we have Cardiff versus
Connacht.
We have Ulster versus Edinburgh. They're kind of winner-take-all-ish.
The really interesting one, if you take the Irish hat off, is if Connacht get a win and results go the other way, is you could have no teams from the Grand Slam champions,
no Welsh teams
qualifying for Europe next year, which would be, and it's not that outlandish a possibility now. It's one or two results away, which is, it's hard to understand how that's even possible, really. But
that has been the tradition for the last few years. So all the passion.
Has there ever been any year without one Welsh team in Europe, though?
No. I mean, there was one with Scottish, all right, or a few. But it would show the disconnect between the success that happens in the Millennium Stadium and in the regions is growing. What else do we have to talk about?
I suppose Van Graan's new contract is one thing. I'd be interested to see what the lads think of this A tournament that's going on in the States at the minute with players missing.
Come at it fresh for me and for listeners. The A tournament.
There's a tournament called the Cara Cup at the minute. That's Munster's A team, Leinster's A team, and the New England Free Jacks who will play in. Sorry, New England that will play in the MLR next year, Major League Rugby. They're not even a competing team yet. So they go. So Munster played New England on Saturday. They played Munster and Leinster played today, and then Leinster played New England team towards the end of the week. And Ulster and Connacht did something similar a couple of weeks back. But I suppose where it's interesting is that you're at the final stages of the All-Ireland League at this point, and a lot of those players have contributed to their clubs all season, now aren't available, and it seems to be part of a bigger argument where they were looking to restructure the league. Mm. The clubs resisted off their own bat, it seems, to be fair.
This was where the B of I Cup was thrown into this mix at the beginning of the season.
Yeah, so the argument is that if the league wasn't to be restructured to be more relevant to the professional game, they would need additional A matches, I don't know. There's a bit of a standoff going on at this point, but I think we'd all like to see the league as a the top level of club rugby as a viable third tier. I certainly would anyway.
Yeah, it's a bit pointed to have this, I suppose, tournament at the time of the season it is, but there's just not enough weeks in the year, isn't there? There's too many competitions vying for.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, where are they better served over playing the Free Jacks or playing in a
that is their
decisive
name, is
game
it?
In the All Ireland
the Free
League.
Jacks. Do you know, is it Free Jack some sort of rare toad that exists?
No idea what it is really. Yeah. Okay. They're not very good, I don't think, anyway. They've lost all their matches heavily.
Okay. Well, maybe they want to go over there rather than play AIL. I mean, is it a better thing to do?
What do you think?
Well, I guess I'm kind of caught up in that we've got Clontarfa playing this weekend, last game of the season.
Where are you at the moment? You've top
third,
four. But
we're third, yeah. So we're in semi-finals. So we play Lansdowne this weekend with kind of a winner takes all to get home semi-final against Lansdowne again. So
second, third.
But Lansdowne are affected as well as we are. They're missing a few players over there. I think we're missing, well, we have a couple of young guys over as well, two or three maybe. But look, we've known about it for a long time, so it's, they can kind of understand it a little bit, but then if we were chasing for something like, or trying to avoid relegation or something like that, I think it's a different kettle of fish, you know, and you're kind of going, well, we've played with these guys all week.
And I think it was
the colleges teams actually could struggle. Sorry, UCD are missing a fair whack.
But wasn't it, it was the clubs from the second and third division that had a problem with the alleged restructure, but yet it's the clubs in Division 1 who were affected. So it's the clubs who aren't even going to be involved in this that have kind of slowed things down, as far as I understand. So it's a messy situation, and it's an important.
I wouldn't like to
resolved.
Be the clubs. I just like reading the runes of it. It looks to me that the clubs have no power.
I suppose, look, if their wages are being paid, even if it's just an academy commitment, that's where the buck
stops. It's hard to stand in front of a player and say, right, you're not going, you know, just to fulfil a club thing, you know. And personally, it's a great opportunity for some players who aren't in academies to hold their hand up, and we want to be a kind of stepping stone towards professionalism.
Yeah, I just don't want the pretense of a debate. There seems to be none. It's done and dusted, and it's done from Lansdowne Road, and they get most things right. They get some things wrong. They got the sevens right anyway. No thanks in no part to Billy and the lads on the pitch, but I presume it was the fellas in suits who really got it right. A word on Ronan O'Mahony. He's announced his retirement today. We wish him well.
Yeah. Geez, he was an unbelievable player. Like what he could do, he could turn that on a sixpence, the speed he had. And I played with Ronan when I was down in Munster, and his brother Barry. And yeah, look, he'd be a sad loss. And to retire from injuries, look, I think he's been injured for a while now, and still, I think it's going to be a tough one for him to take. But it's a brave decision for him to do it. And look, I just wish him all the best in what he goes on to do.
He was so, I mean, every rugby player has to be combative, but he was.
I think he was the same under-20s team as Conor Murray, Madigan, McKinley, Andrew Burke was a big star that didn't kind of go on. So he's probably, what, 28 now? So yeah, it's early to be called a day, in fairness.
It is, yeah. Yeah, we hope the rest of his life goes well for him outside of rugby, or whether he's staying in it or not. But listen, I presume he'll take a break anyway. Best of luck, Ronan. I'm going to just give you the last word, Billy, because you've been good enough to come in. You are the man of the moment. Give us, when's your next rugby match?
My next rugby match? We're going to London at the end of May. So we're going there for the World Series. We're an invitational team there.
But that's part of this year's tournament.
That's part of this year's tournament. But we're just an invitational team because we won the European Grand Prix last summer.
Okay.
So we came third last year. So yes, I think we're going to try and better it this year.
Yeah. That was kind of announcing to people that you were on the way. And then when is the first of the Jamborees?
The first of the Jamborees?
Yeah, the first of the series. Like when's
next December we'll go to Dubai.
That's it.
Very start of December. So we'll start pre-season September. We get stuck into that.
A big Olympic qualification before that.
That's the autumn, isn't it?
That's in July. That's the middle of July.
Is it all done over a series of a couple of days, or how does that?
It's done. So we have we've one European tournament in Moscow at the start of July, and that's a seeding tournament for the Olympic qualifier, and that'll just be a 2-day tournament in Clomiers, I think it is, down in France. Yeah. So it'll just be a Saturday, Sunday, 3 games each day, winner takes all.
And so the Moscow one is to get you into top seeding in your group.
Yeah, so that'll just be a European tournament. Hopefully we'll put ourselves in good shape. I think a lot will depend on how England go over the next few months, because they're the Great Britain teams. If they get top 4 in the World Series, they'll automatically qualify, which will take them out of that qualifying tournament.
But you have to win that second tournament that you're talking about,
it's winner takes all.
It'll
be big pressure again.
Sure, it last week, no bother.
Yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah, hopefully.
Well, thank you, and we wish you well. It'll be fun to watch that in December, never mind about the Olympic qualification in the meantime, but thanks for coming in. No,
thanks very much for having me.
Not at all, it's been a pleasure. So that's it, that's the RTE podcast for another week. Thanks to Wes Liddy, thanks to James Downey, thanks to Billy Dardis, who you just heard there, thanks to Michael Glennon, and thanks to Ronan Lawler and Gara Duffy for putting it all together. We'll speak to you soon. Don't forget, you can download it on SoundCloud, Spotify, and all the places where you usually get your podcasts. Till the next time, go easy.